Welcome to Grumpy Strategists, episode 44. I'm your host, SAA's Michael Shoebridge, and I'm here with Strategic Analysis Australia's head of research, Dr. Marcus Hellyer. And we've both got some jet lag.
Well, first of all, we're back in the bunker. It's good to be home, but I think we did some good work up there in Korea. It was short notice, but we did manage to salvage the destroyer. I mean, people said we were crazy.
They said it couldn't be done.
Balloons? Salvage a ship with some balloons? I mean, they mocked us. We showed them.
Well, I like to think it was my suggestion.
That's what?
Mr. Kim. Okay, look, I think let's come clean. Dennis Rodman made a call to me while we were over there riding the destroyer. I talked it through with him. He came up with the balloon thing.
In fact, he watched as it all happened. He was supervising. So it's back up. I think we have been appropriately compensated. They are going to name the ship the Grumpy Strategus, which I believe in Korean is... It's got a ring to it.
Excellent. The good ship Grumpy Strategus.
Yes, and there was a small land deal. That spot of coastal real estate that Donald Trump was going to develop, unfortunately languishing at the moment.
The great thing is it's got development approval already because of that great work done back at the Trump-Kim summits.
And it
took us there and we had a beautiful lunch there. And the view you'll have from the villas.
I mean, the Korean Riviera, so underrated.
It'll be, just a great opportunity for SAA to get its foot in the door in North Korean real estate. So that was
But we're back and it's like, what is going on here? All people can talk about is what percentage of GDP should Australia be spending. I think it should be 50. I mean, after talking to the North Koreans, 50 is about the right number there. Here, people think you're crazy if you say 3%.
Talking with my Russian friends, they're thinking 40 is about right for them. Mm-hmm. But they did put a little footnote there saying that that's only because they're getting a lot of Chinese stuff on the cheap. So, really, that has to be factored in. So if you haven't got that mainline to the Chinese electronics industry, you probably are looking. Kim Jong-un has got that right, I think, about 50%.
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking maybe 3%. But every time you say 3%, there's this chorus. You get this chorus of responses in this, dare I say it, rather pompous kind of voice about how you're missing the point.
Well, I call these, it's a great pun, you're going to love this, myth takes people often. It's a myth take. And
are they mocking people with speech impediments?
I've got about five common myth takes about this whole debate about the defence budget and defence spending. Let me put the first one to you, Dr. Hellyer.
Sure.
Because I'm someone who has put a figure out about what the budget should be. I've said 3.5%. I've sort of sat halfway between the two. But it's wrong to put a percentage of GDP out in the debate about our defence budget. Because we should be talking about capabilities, not the percentage of GDP, right? And I've heard this from government figures, from officials, and also from a whole bunch of people on various social media platforms.
Sorry, you should have said that with a much more pompous tone of voice. Oh, my dear chap. I mean, that is an amateur mistake, a rookie error to talk percentages. We need to be talking. Forgive me if I'm wrong, though, Michael. Hasn't defence actually done this for a long time? I thought when they published things like the Integrated Investment Program, they actually had determined what capabilities we need.
You could be onto something there, that the IIP is actually a gigantic list of capabilities. And in fact, there's a bunch of stuff on a bigger list that doesn't make it in to the IIP.
Well, yes, this is the thing, is that defence, we did the DSR, and the DSR, now Defence Strategic Review, conducted by two eminent Australians with some background in the defence space, actually said this is the big picture and these are the kinds of capabilities you needed to be getting, such as long-range strike and maritime strategy and amphibiosity and all the rest of this stuff. But then defence went away and spent a year rebuilding the IIP to actually fit inside the funding envelope, which resulted in them ejecting $70 to $80 billion worth of stuff because it didn't fit the funding envelope. We'd actually said we needed this stuff. We had actually have been saying in various strategic documents and investment plans, we need ballistic missile defence and longer range air defence. And a bit of maritime mine clearance would be good if we're a trading power and we need to keep our ports open. And some few more armoured vehicles, maybe a few more
support ships,
jets,
supply ships.
Supply ships. They were We had worked out what capabilities we needed, but they got booted out because 2% of GDP is not enough.
So are you saying on myth number one, Marcus, that people like Richard Marles and Pat Conroy...
Are you saying do they like Richard Marles
and Pat Conroy? No, when they criticise people for fixating on a percentage of GDP that should be the defence budget, because they're... And they're saying the reason these people are so wrong is because they should be focusing on capabilities, because what you spend pops out after you know what capabilities you need. They've actually done the opposite to what they're talking about, because they've had a big list of capabilities with price tags and they haven't funded them. They've just set a ceiling, which happens to be at the moment 2%, and anything on that list of capabilities that can't fit within that is gone.
Yes, that is indeed exactly what I'm saying. They have actually done what they said you shouldn't do, which is to set a percentage of GDP, and then you have to fit the capabilities you can afford to that, which means the capabilities you've determined you need are no longer in there.
Yes, but just to be fair to the current ministers, this has happened every time with every government under every defence white paper I've been involved in. There is always an arbitrary funding envelope set.
Correct.
And that's about what's the appetite of the government to fund defence. So all this nonsense about if you had a list of capabilities that would generate a budget number and that should be the number, that is utter nonsense. That is not how the Australian government works.
Well, it's not how any government does it. Basically, governments are under huge funding pressure because you've got to fund health and education and all the other good stuff out there. So you are making a kind of touchy-feely almost risk-based informed decision about here's my priorities, here's where defence sits inside that those larger priorities.
And if you're willing to leave a big list of capabilities that your eminent reviewers and your internal experts tell you they need on the cutting room floor because they don't fit within the funding envelope, you're demonstrating your priorities.
You're just demonstrating your priorities, and you're also demonstrating whether you actually believe your own strategic risk assessment. So when you say we are in the most strategically dangerous, uncertain time since World War II, but then you spend less money than you have at particular points since World War II.
Be taken seriously, and you're not taking yourself seriously. So here's myth number two.
Yes.
It's another take on the myth. Oh, it's another myth take.
Yeah, we got it the first time, Michael. 2%, doesn't get funnier.
I think it was really funny the first time. 2% of GDP is more than enough for Australia's defence. You just have to buy the right stuff.
Yes, the trouble is the right stuff is sort of determined by what you think you're going to have to do and who you're going to have to do it to.
And when you're going to have to do it.
And when you're going to have to. So you need to have a pretty good understanding of the realm of possibilities and neck that down to the possibility which you think is probably the most likely or the most dangerous.
Well, the good news is I think assets are extremely predictable in war. And this is why the Russians have been succeeding so well fighting a much smaller power called Ukraine, because the Russian way of war was inherited by the Ukrainians. The Russians knew it would be a fight of conventional power. And they knew that the Ukrainians were going to fight the same way the Russians were, except none of that happened.
Yes, so 2% might work if you plan the way your adversary is going to attack you. You then prepare how to defeat that. And then when they actually do attack you, they attack you the way that you thought they were going to and you've planned for. So if they assemble their maritime task force and they do a charge of the Light Brigade straight at Australia, and we have our force of some, you know, small number of F-5s, some long-range anti-ship missiles.
We've got the wedge tail. And tankers, targeting.
You know, and we sink their task force.
With the precision-guided munitions, right? Yeah. Like they'll RASM, you know, we're firing harpoons, I'm imagining, but so we don't have any. Tomahawks, we've got those tomahawks.
It all goes according to script. The only problem is that no adversary in the history of the world really has attacked you the way you were expecting. And certainly if you defeat their first attack, then they, unless it's Blackadder, then they try something different.
They don't just give up.
And a major power adversary has a lot more options than we do. So I just don't think that if we have our boutique force designed to defeat maritime task forces, that the adversary, that costs us exactly 2% of GDP, that the bad guys are going to be nice enough to attack us with a carefully tailored maritime task force that is just small enough for us to defeat it.
just big enough for them to bother to send, but just small enough so that we can defeat it with the weapon platforms and small number of actual weapons that we have.
Well, it also has to be big enough to justify us getting fives and LRASMs and all that stuff. So it's the Goldilocks thing.
Yeah.
You know, it's scary enough for us to get some really cool stuff, but not big enough.
Well, then that's true for the army
for us
too,
to
isn't
be
it?
Unable the
new
to defeat it.
Amphibiosity of the army, you know, take itself very littorally. It's got just enough to lodge a small force somewhere really dangerous, but nothing to flow a bigger force in behind because there is no bigger
there
force.
There is no bigger force.
So it has to be an extremely tight scenario where the adversary is polite enough to mean that a very small Australian lodgment is powerful and effective.
Yeah. But so we can do that on 2% of GDP.
You could do that on 2%, but it just wouldn't be a credible capability.
It doesn't really reflect many real worlds.
How about this one? Well, yep. Australia can't spend enough to matter anyway, and we're never going to fight alone. And if we spend all of our GDP, we still wouldn't be able to hurt the Chinese military. So what's the point anyway? Very like climate change. I mean, why should we make any contribution to climate change?
I mean, it's the freeloader argument. Well, I mean, look, okay, yes, okay, so the US spends this much money, very huge amount of money, and then sort of
a
maybe half the size
US,
of that amount of money. You've got China.
Yep.
You know, even the Chinese one is 10, 20 times more than we've got, so we could double our spending. It won't make any difference in the long run, which is kind of, yes, the freeloader argument that we can't make any difference.
So why should we try?
A couple of arguments against that. First one is, well, actually, we have made a difference in World War One on the Western Front. We made a huge difference in the Southwest Pacific, in World War Two, in North Africa, in World War Two. We made a huge difference. So middle powers can make a difference.
Yep.
And the second argument is in all, whether we're talking climate change, whether we're talking military effects, regardless of what we're talking, is countries act together. That is the whole principle of
collective
action. And you contribute according to your means.
Yes.
And Australia actually has considerable means which we can leverage here.
And
it's
a
total cop-out to say we can't make any difference. I mean, why is the government actually trying to get to net zero if they don't think we can make any difference in climate change?
That it is bizarre, isn't it? This is a cherry-picking argument. Well, with the things I don't want to take seriously, I'll say, well, we can't make a difference. The things I do want to take seriously, I say, well, if everybody had that attitude, nothing would happen.
Mm-hmm.
So
yep.
It's just an argument of convenience. Well, how about this one?
Yep.
All right. Okay. All right, Mr. Smarty Pants. Myth number four. Before you start saying we should spend more on defence, even if you've got that thing you call a capability plan, even if you've got stuff I wasn't funding, before you can tell me what I need to spend and what I need to spend it on, you need to tell me where the money's coming from.
Okay, I will.
What? Okay.
All right, let's end negative gearing.
That's a terrible idea. Rich people need negative gearing.
Let's tax super balances over $3 million.
That's a terrible idea for the reason I just gave.
Let's reduce the growth rate of the NDIS.
Who are the winners and losers in this?
This is the issue, isn't it? It's like, sure, I can come up with all of this kind of stuff. And in fact, the government has an entire Department of State called the Treasury, whose job it is to come up with these ideas. So the government is well aware of these ideas. They don't need me to tell them these
ideas. Well, they're also political choices.
Yes.
And that's what politicians and governments are all about. And it's back to that thing, I think, about prioritisation. So if you take your own words seriously about we're in the most dangerous time since the end of World War II, then your actions should involve increasing our military power to improve our security. And if that must mean, yes, you need trade-offs. So some of the things like tax cuts, like negative gearing, need to be not just on the table, but savings to fund those things. And as you say, there are probably lots of other good ideas, and the finance department knows where the money's being spent. And the Treasury knows where money can come from. So it is their job.
Yeah. I mean, and if these guys, if you don't want to get elected.
Yeah, you don't want to make the choices.
This is your job. This is why you get elected.
Yeah.
So if you don't want to exercise your job by making difficult prioritisation decisions that may piss off parts of the electorate, don't run for government.
How about this one? This is the fifth myth. We're already making historic increases. So how very dare you suggest that we have to increase this defence budget? This defence budget is bigger than any defence budget in previous times, even quite bigly ones, and it's getting bigger every year.
Mm.
These are historic generational increases.
Well, the only problem with that argument is that it's simply not true.
Well, that's disappointing.
I know ministers like saying it is, but it's simply not true. The defence budget can grow in a number of ways, and sort of the most obvious way is it grows in nominal dollars. So each year, the number of dollars gets bigger.
Like the annual Australian economy grows unless there's a recession, and like the revenue take grows if there are major tax cuts.
Yeah, so every year and every set of forward estimates, so the next four financial years, is by default, by definition, the biggest in history.
Some of that's real growth, some of that's inflation,
okay,
isn't it?
So then there's real growth, yes, so it's also growing in real terms. And you go, well, if it's growing in real terms, it must be getting bigger in real terms, and it must be growing as a percentage of GDP. Well, no, it's not, because guess what? GDP is growing in real terms as well, unless we have recessions, and we have not had recessions.
It's getting bigger as well.
So it's getting bigger as well. Yeah. As a percentage of GDP, however, the defence budget is barely grown. So we have hovered within 0.1% of 2% of GDP since about 1617, and it's going to be like that until about 26-27. Yeah, so we have a decade of stasis.
Once that nadir under the Rudd-Gillard-Rudd government
it's
pretty much got to just a whisker around 2% and just stayed there.
Yeah, and that, I know the Conservatives like bashing up the Labor government, and they probably should for that, those 2 years, but that was a sort of one-off thing back in the olden days when people still fools thought that getting into the budget into surplus was a good idea and the Gillard government thought they could get into surplus by cutting defense.
Modern monetary theory says you don't need to worry about that.
Well, we can have a whole episode on this on Trump's budgeting. So yeah, the budget is not growing in historic terms, and we're around 2% of GDP during the Cold War, which apparently not as dangerous a period of time as where we are today, we were spending around 3%. So to talk about historic increases is, I think, a complete distortion of where we are. Plus the new money that the current government did put more money into the funding line in the National Defence Strategy. Yep.
$50 billion.
Yeah, the $50 billion in the forward estimates, and it goes on two projects. It goes on nuclear powered submarines and the general purpose frigate. But even then, to make it fit, they had to rip out $70 to $80 billion worth of other planned capabilities.
Telling me it wasn't capability based, it was budget driven again. This is so disappointing. And there was that other little matter of the rate of inflation over the last 4 years has outstripped the rate of growth of the budget. The defence has taken a real cut. So these historic generational increases don't even make up for the annual cut that defence is still living with because of inflation.
Yeah, so we have to sort of be very precise in language here, and that we've had this discussion before, but the defence budget has grown in real terms, but not at the rate that was planned because of the effects of inflation.
Yeah, so that was a cut to the planned growth.
Yes, essentially defence has less buying power.
Yeah, so there's six myths. There are more, but I think my favourite is...
Was that six or was that five?
Oh, it's five.
Five, because there is number six. And this is, again, one of my favourite ones, which is, well, you got to fix defence first. Before you give those hopeless losers, they'll just blow all your money, never deliver anything. And I have to say that there's an element of truth to that. But you got to fix defence first before you can give them any more money, because they'll just waste it. And it's like, come on, there will never be a perfect bureaucracy. Please define, what does fixed mean?
Well, look, I do have a bit of sympathy with this argument. I must admit, when I was in the Department of Finance or in the Prime Minister's Department, I'd look over the lake in Canberra from the finance building or from the Prime Minister's building.
Well, you have binoculars set up there.
It's not very far. Mm-hmm. And over the lake, you would see the defence precinct, the Russell compound. And you would know that if you tossed extra money over there, the way they rolled meant you'd just get more of the same. And unfortunately, that's true. However, if we live in the most dangerous time since the Second World War, waiting for defence to be perfect before you do anything about it is really just an excuse for inaction. In fact, my net assessment of all six of these myths is they're all trotted out so that once the myth is stated, the consequence is you don't have to do anything.
Yes.
So these are all excuses for inaction.
Correct. Yes.
So that's six myths.
Yeah. But what I would also just add to that in this part of the net assessment is they all underpin the current government's kind of justifications.
They will
wheel these all out. I mean, they won't necessarily say you have to fix defence first, because then they would actually have to admit that they've been running defence for the last 3 and a bit years and it's still broken, so oops, we haven't been very good at our job.
Will patiently explain how defence moves slowly, which is another way
they
of saying
ponderously it's broken. Defence's yes. ponderousness.
Yes.
All right, moving on.
So,
what else happened in Korea?
It's a mythical episode because there's been a bunch. While we were helping Kim Jong-un out with his destroyer, and look, Dennis Rodman was helpful with the balloon idea, but it was basically in the way for the rest of it. So mm-hmm. we were pretty busy. Other people were busy too, and let's not go through a whole lot of detail about the Ukrainians' continued demonstration that different ways of fighting
are drones. Michael, it is such old hat. Why do you keep coming back to these drones? Such old hat.
That's
such
the drone myth I wanted to get to.
Come on. And look, let's face it, the nature of war never changes anyway. So drones, they come and go. Crossbows come and go. Machine guns come and go. I mean, atomic weapons come and go. I mean, look, the nature of war doesn't change.
Well,
stop chasing after the latest, greatest little fad, Michael.
Are you going to tell me at the end of the day war is a human construct?
War is a human construct.
And are you going to tell me it's a matter of will?
It is. Humans fighting with will. That's what war's about.
Is it about the warrior
Stop
culture?
Stop obsessing about these gadgets. Technology. Technology comes and goes, Michael. And in fact, a lot of technologies, like drones. If you went and bought drones today, they're out of date tomorrow.
I've heard this one.
You know, so stop obsessing about drones.
In the Australian debate, I wouldn't even call it a debate, discussion perhaps of drone warfare and whether the ADF should get any. And somebody say, look, this is all nonsense. Defence did buy some DJI drones a few years ago and it had to throw them all away.
Actually. It was fun.
Had to throw them all away.
Oh, really?
And that means that it's silly to buy drones because you might have to throw them away.
Silly.
Another great argument along those lines is, and the other reason you don't want to buy a drone, it's not because the Chinese might turn them off in the case of DJI drones. The reason you don't want to buy a drone now is it could be obsolete in a few years. So you need to make the right timing decision to buy the drone and buy it when you need it, because then it won't be obsolete.
I'm buying it from.
But that's not important. You just got to, you see how it would be a mistake to do anything but what I just told you?
So it's like the lawyers in the parachute? So the economists in the parachutes and the plane that's crashing, it's like they'll appear when you need them.
Demand is sufficient.
So what you're saying is if the bad guys attack us, we will start buying drones. Then the drones will appear.
We will know the right kind and we'll know that we need them now. And we may have a few regrets that we didn't get a few earlier. Yeah.
Right.
But the other interesting thing about this is that logic of, well, you shouldn't buy anything now because it will be obsolete in the future. That, to me, jars a little bit with programs like the nuclear submarine program, where we're buying
Sorry. Are you daring to suggest that SSNs of a design we're doing now may be obsolete in 30 years' time?
I'm just observing the interesting intellectual gap between it's a mistake to buy a drone now because it could be obsolete in a small number of years, but it's right to spend $368 billion buying 8 submarines.
Michael, drones will never replace crewed platforms. Drone cannot replace a crewed platform, so just give up on the drone stuff. Come on. Now, I read this interesting thing, vaguely interesting thing. It was on LinkedIn or somewhere where somebody's going, sorry, I'm trying to get my pompous voice on. Those Ukrainians, what they did, striking those Russian bombers. I mean, there's nothing new or novel about that. I mean, David Sterling and the SAS were doing that in the North African desert in World War II, and they destroyed far more German aircraft than the Ukrainians have done. Well, there's nothing new here.
It's mainly about derring do, isn't it? But I thought there was something novel because they didn't have to expose a whole lot of extremely brave, in short supply, people with unique skills, like the SAS, for example, Special Forces. There weren't captured and killed Ukrainian Special Forces operatives. There were small pieces of fragmentized drones, along with small pieces of fragmentized Russian aircraft. So I think there are some inherent advantages to how the Ukrainians did it.
Yes, so this argument about, I've heard this before, and I have countered it before. Now, I mean, if we take modern drone systems, whether air, land, or surface, maritime surface drones, undersea drones, we are already at the point you know, well before the Ukrainian strikes, where all those kinds of what I call minnow operations, where you take crazy brave people and they go get into, like, they parachute in or they go in on
Singapore Harbor to
mini subs, human torpedoes
during the Second World War,
snorkeling
the Italians.
You know,
yep,
drone systems can do that already. But the good thing is a yes, you don't need to find a whole bunch of crazy brave people who, as often as not, get killed or captured.
Well, the second set of raids that followed up the success of the crate raid, the small fishing vessel.
Yeah, so an Anglo-Australian raid on Singapore Harbour to sink some Japanese
first
traders.
It was very successful. The frogmen putting limpet mines on ships. The second one, they all died.
Literally, they all died. So, and using drone systems, if the first attack doesn't work, you can do it all again the next day. You can just keep sending stuff again and again and again. And that shapes the adversary's thinking. And we saw this with the Ukrainian attack. So not only did they destroy a large percentage of Russia's bomber fleet, but in the following days, the Russian transportation system was paralyzed as the Russians were looking for hidden drones in trucks.
Every truck was a suspicious potential adversary. And then the Ukrainians used railway carriages to launch drones to destroy a regiment worth of Russian armoured and other vehicles on the train. So just when they're all Russians are all looking at trucks, it turns out trains were the next thing.
So it may well be that the nature of war is eternal and unchanging, and it comes down to a battle of wills. And, you know, insert your Clausewitzian concept here. That actually tells you nothing about how war is being fought today and will be fought in the near future.
Well, it can be unfair and surprising. It reminds me, I remember when I was at high school, two guys from my high school had an argument at after school tennis, and one of them
was Paul.
It wasn't him. And the other one we'll call Stefan. And Stefan was South Korean, but he'd moved to Australia. Yes. And Paul grew up in Sydney.
The South Korean was called Stefan.
Anglo.
Okay.
Yeah, very unusual. Right. Anyway, they get into an argument, and Paul, the Anglo-Australian, wants to fight Stefan, the South Korean. And Stefan doesn't want to fight. He's a peaceful guy. But no, Paul was insisting. So Paul takes his tie off and starts looking like he wants to box. South Korean pal takes his shirt off and does a series of stretches after taking his shoes off as well. All these stretches and jumps and things. It turns out he was actually an expert in Taekwondo. And the end of the story was he ended the fight pretty much before it started by tapping Paul lightly on one ear and then another ear with different feet. And Paul kept yelling, "Fight Australian, fight Australian."
Hang on, this is going back to the previous myth where we expect the bad guys to attack us in just the kind of way we can defeat with 2%.
But it may well be that my former school chum, Paul, although his friends with Stefan as well, is now a defence planner.
It could be.
The next thing I have, though, is that the UK has put out their strategic defence review.
No, defence strategic review, isn't it?
Well, you might notice this one's called an SDR, which I think that's a mistake they made. Because
Hang on, are you talking about our DSR, our defence strategic review?
Well, that's a funny thing you mentioned that, because I started reading it. It's about 144 pages.
So they're different documents?
Well, no, they're not. It turns out,
because they seem to have a very similar name.
Well, it turns out that the UK SDR, Strategic Defence Review.
So same words, different order.
SDR 2025 appears to have infringed the copyright of the Australian government's Defence Strategic Review done in 2023.
Oh, so what you're saying is that the three deep insiders embedded in the UK system who did the SDR have taken the work of the two deeply embedded defence insiders who did the Australian DSR and essentially changed a few names and percentages?
I mean, it could be like, you know, there was Darwin is alleged to have come up with the theory of evolution, but there was another scientist who published something
his name
around
Michael
the same
is
time.
Alfred Russel Wallace.
We don't care what his name was because...
How dare you?
It could be that they pretty much simultaneously came up with exactly the same thing. Because when I read the 144 pages, I felt like I was just reading something again. And the reason is...
It's the same.
Echo of everything in the Australian DSA.
Well, it's sort of what you get if you take a bunch of deeply embedded defence insiders who've been doing this forever, and they look out the window and go, oh, things are changing. So we've got to tweak a few things here, and then we'll call it. What we're going to call it is generational change.
And it's a root and branch review.
A root branch review, and we have to pivot to a new way of war.
Business as usual is no longer acceptable.
It's bizarre that these motherhood statements are almost the same, even to the point of... So, well, we've had one defence for a long time. We had one defence since the big review we did nearly a decade ago. So they've now adopted a one defence mindset. Which, yes. I think, coming back from North Korea, I think where everybody thinks the same is a very good thing.
It's a very good thing. Yes.
So, but innovationification is also a big thing in that one. So there's 141 references to innovationification.
Look, hats off. That's a bigger number than our Australian DSR team managed.
So it is way more innovative.
Yep, they're bringing more innovation.
More innovationification. Now, we may mock, but at least let's just say that, remember how we're just talking about you don't set a funding envelope, you determine what case you need. I mean, it'd be a rookie error.
Yep.
They have actually done the rookie error. So they have set a funding envelope starting at 2.3%, increasing in the sort of short term to 2.5%, and then maybe one day, hopefully, when the economic and fiscal conditionals allow, getting to 3%. So they're doing better than us because we are at 2%. Hoping to get to 2.33.
Well, I actually think the Prime Minister is hoping not to get there, but he's wanting to sound like he hopes to get to 2.3.
But they have conducted the same rookie error that we conducted, but that only stupid rookies do, but which both governments have done.
Well, I just hope Richard Marles and Pat Conroy are not going to turn up and call Keir Starmer a rookie who's made a gross political error by mentioning a percentage of GDP.
You're going to 2.5. What kind of a fool are you? You got to determine first what capabilities you need. And by the way, the capabilities they've determined they need are 12 nuclear-powered attack submarines. So they're going to go from 8 to 12 there.
Well, look, let me come back to that. But I've just got to... This is a great piece of political wordsmithing by Keir Starmer, the UK Prime Minister, when he made the stirring speech about the UK's security on the 2nd of June.
He looked great on that aircraft carrier.
Yes.
I mean, many are called, but few are chosen to, you know, have that whole Top Gun kind of jacket
going
on.
I wasn't thinking of George W. Bush on the aircraft carrier with mission accomplished about Iraq when it wasn't accomplished.
You're just jealous because we don't have an aircraft carrier to do your guest appearance.
I loved Keir Starmer's stirring stuff. This is a blueprint to make Britain safer and stronger, a battle-ready, armour-clad nation with the strongest alliances, most advanced capabilities, equipped for the decades to come. And we have already acted, announcing the largest sustained increase in defence spending since the end of the Cold War. That's a historic increase.
Historic increases in funding. Heard that one.
Raising it to 2.5% of GDP by 2027. And this is the best bit. Setting the ambition to hit 3% in the next parliament.
It's good to set your ambitions.
Subject to economic and fiscal conditions. So it's that... It reminded me of late night television. You know, free gifts available. And then you get a little footnote. Terms and conditions apply.
Well, look, come on, you're being too cynical. They have found, we've spoken about the cost capability death spiral, how stuff gets more and more expensive as the capability gets more exquisite, so you get fewer and fewer of them, you know, and no one's really found a way to break out of that. They've found a way to break out of it, Michael.
They have.
Because...
The army?
It's called the recce strike model for the army. They are not increasing the size of the army.
No.
But they will deliver a tenfold increase in lethality. No more people, 10 times more lethal. Top that.
So lethalification increases 10% by 10 times. This is sounding...
That's 1,000%. If we're talking in percentages, it's 1,000%.
It's sounding like the perfume industry. You know how they come out with all these new skincare industry? You know, now with 150%... hydrolyphicization. Now with 10 times the lethalization of the previous UK army. Wow. Well, that's impressive.
But despite that increase, still they anticipate it will become necessary to increase the UK's active reserve forces by at least 20%. Oh, hang on. When funding allows, most likely in the 2030s.
Subject to economic and fiscal conditions, as the Prime Minister said. Yeah, that's another thing that really struck me as a parallel with the Defence Strategic Review. So the two eminent reviewers, they're trusted insiders who are now outsiders looking in. They get thanked for their work, and then the government and the defence organisation get hold of that, and they don't do what the review said.
Yes, well, just as it here, the DSR delivered their work and then Defence spent a year developing an investment program, a force structure that somehow was congruent with the intent of the DSR but matched the funding envelope that had been predetermined. And it took them a year to do that, and $70 to $80 billion worth of stuff was ejected. The SDR in the UK was not accompanied with an investment program. It was fitted for, but not with a plan and actually setting out how this would
and
become
let me
reality.
Guess that will be done by the UK Defence Organisation itself in responding to the review. In fact, I think it's called in the UK language a defence command paper will be worked on over this next year.
I like that word, command.
Yeah, so again, very similar. Now, get a review, make it a little bit arm's length from government, but have it by insider outsiders, then be able to cogitate about the review, and then once the government's cogitated and made some announcements, pass the baby over back to the people that gave you the problem in the first place, the defence organisation, for them to make the magic happen.
Yep. Now, there are a couple of things I am a little concerned about in here from an Australian perspective, other than the shameless ripping off of our copyright and intellectual property.
I would like to see the intellectual property rights at least contested by the Australian government, and maybe Smith... Hey. Call me a conspiracist, but Stephen Smith served as Australia. Thank you. Served as the UK High Commissioner before taking this task up.
And Sir Angus Houston, aristocrat, you know.
Well, one of the last people to be made a sir.
Yeah, just like the
revitalized
sir doing the SDR.
So I'm not saying, but I am just
secret handshakes kind of stuff.
Yeah, I just think there's some interesting straws in the wind there.
But as an Australian, one of the things I'm a little concerned about here is things like this line: by more purposefully using its market power and by prioritising UK-based businesses, Defence should also strive to deliver for the UK economy. So hang on, what was that bit about us unifying the three industrial bases?
The UK, Western Australia,
yeah. No barriers,
yeah, that's
we're all one big happy family.
That's a generational historic harmonising of the three countries' industrial bases.
Hang on, the UK is going to prioritise UK-based businesses, it says.
Well, it says it for two reasons, actually. It says it for economic reasons, so they spend local money for local people and local jobs, but also because they need to have local production when crises come.
So they have to deliver for the warfighter.
Yes, so that does kind of collide with the AUKUS unified industrial base. But while we're on AUKUS-y things, this was one of the most heroic, in a yes minister sense of things, part of the strategic defence review. They're actually increasing the number of their nuclear submarines. They're getting to 12 attack submarines, I think, which I find extraordinary, because I think you've got some numbers on this. One simple number is their current production rate has to be doubled, but it actually gets worse than that when you look at tonnage. So why don't you just tell us about, by saying they're going to go to 12.
Just sort of noodling with numbers. So, yes, SSN AUKUS, Snorkus to its friends. That's the submarine we're meant to be building at some point in the future. So
design is already very mature, according to the Australian submarine.
No one's ever actually been able to tell me how mature the Snorkus design is. I did have a couple of interesting conversations with people who said, nah, it's nowhere near detailed design.
I mean, in human terms, when you get very, very mature, you start to have some gaps, like you forget things, bits of you fall off. If it's very mature, there could be some big holes.
Anyway, so the UK has sort of 6 or 7 SSNs at the moment, so the Astute program, the current build program, is meant to deliver 7. They're not quite finished with that yet. They have 4 SSBNs, so ballistic missile submarines, as their strategic deterrent,
The dreadnought.
Yes, so that's where they have been, is 1 Astute every 3 years.
Right.
So,
yes.
And an Astute is roughly 7,200 tons. So 1 Astute every 3 years is roughly 2,400 tonnes of submarine a year is sort of coming through the pipeline.
And these are complex tonnages, complex tonnages.
Yeah, these are, as people delight in saying, the most the most complex machines known to humankind.
More complex than the space shuttle.
Well, space shuttle is, that's back in 20th century. So about 2,400 tonnes of submarine a year
is what they're currently
working through the sausage machine. Well, SSN Orcus is going to be over 10,000 tonnes, so bigger submarine. Then the UK, according to the SDR, is going to go to one submarine, one SSN, every year and a half. So instead of one every 3 years, one every 1.5 years.
It's going to be building bigger submarines twice as fast double as the smaller submarines.
But we're part of this program as well.
Yeah.
So I don't know what our drumbeat is going to be, but it seems to be about one every 3 years. So we're actually going to, every 3 years, instead of producing one submarine as part of this Snorkus enterprise, we're going to be doing three submarines. So you're actually tripling the throughput. Now, yes, we'll have a shipyard here, but we're not building reactors and we're not building all of the rest of the propulsion system.
The reactor is one of those bottlenecks already, even for the current drumbeat. Yeah.
So that means you're going to be doing roughly 10,000 tons of SSNs a year as part of this enterprise.
Up from about
2,400. So that's four times as much. But the UK's also has now started the Dreadnought program, and the Dreadnought SSBNs are about 17,000, and they're doing roughly one of them every 4 years. So that's another 4,300 tons of submarine coming through the pipeline every year. So you sort of look at that and you go, the Snorkus, or the UK-Australia submarine enterprise,
combined UK-Australian
needs to get 14,300 tons of submarine through the pipeline every year from where they were at about 2,400. So it's about a 500% increase.
You know, there's a lot I love about this. And what I love the most is this really makes those naysayers think again, because a lot of critics have said that the AUKUS optimal pathway is too ambitious. Well, they were wrong, because the UK has just masterfully, exponentially expanded the ambition, but they haven't provided the means.
500% increase in throughput.
I tell you what, it sends a message to those Americans. They're bumping along at 1.2 submarines a year,
trying to get to 2.3 very unsuccessfully. Well, the UK's going to show them.
They're going to increase their production by 500% and then add some more on top.
Well, the US system's actually in exactly the same boat, because they're not just doing Virginias, they're doing bigger Virginias, and they're doing their Columbia class.
But where's their ambition? The UK are committing without needing any more money. And I love that. I think that's terrific. So it's wonderful to end this podcast on such an optimistic note. You know, a recommitment, a metastasizing of commitment.
It's vision. It's vision. You can sit there and harumph, but it's vision.
So look, I see this SDR from the UK as a truly...
DSR? Oh no, SDR.
SDR, subject to intellectual property, right? As a truly historic vision. And I recommend it to Mr. Kim Jong-un for the kind of ambition. And it can be done on the cheap. That's what I love about this. So I think we'll probably record another episode, probably focusing more on the US, because we've left them out of this one.
Mm-hmm.
But
did something happen in the US while we're away?
There's some stuff in my in-tray in the bunker here. Anyway, great to talk with you, Marcus, and really lovely to have an optimistic episode for this occasion.
All right, thank you, Michael, and thank you to all our listeners.